rock band, funk band, blues band. Add a little jam band in there while you're at it. Lansing's Pat Zelenka Project captures all of those styles in its music. We will hear from the Pat Zelenka Project throughout the course of the hour and chat the band up a little bit. They got a lot of interesting stories to tell and a fairly recent CD, and they're working on a new one as well. Pat Zelenka, Bruce Ignatowski, and Raz Rosados. We want Raz to go Bonham on us here before the hour is through. Nobody's ever gone Bonham on Live Music Friday, and we really want that here today. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In November, Ingham County voters will choose a new prosecutor. There are six candidates running for the seat. Current State has already heard from four of them. Today we're joined by another Democratic candidate, Thomas English. Mr. English is a recently retired U.S. administrative law judge, as well as a former federal prosecutor and former cabinet secretary for the Department of Public Safety in New Mexico. Tom English, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark.
Good to have you here. We will ask you what we've been asking every candidate. Just talk to us broadly here about why you're running for Ingham County prosecutor.
Mark, I moved to the area about 12 years ago. Love living in Ingham County. I've been around the world solving problems with the Michigan National Guard that recruited me when I first got here. I've also traveled all around the country solving problems for the federal government. And I decided that it's time to stay home, make contributions back to my own community, and sleep at my own bed a lot more often.
What federal role did you have? What role did you play with the federal government?
Well, I was first an assistant U.S. attorney as a prosecutor and chief of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, which went after drug kingpins and violent gangs that also sold drugs.
This was New Mexico.
Okay. Gang prosecutions and drug kingpin prosecutions went all over the United States. So we reached out to many other states that the tentacles went into. And then I became an administrative law judge for the Social Security Administration. I was offered a position here in Lansing. And also for the last year, I've been working in an executive development program for Social Security to lead some of the 1,500 judges that we have in the United States. When I looked at going around the country, I wake up in Ingham County when I'm home and I look out my back door in my beautiful city of Williamston and I go, I don't want to live anywhere else.
Understood. Which particular issues involving the prosecutor's office do you think are most important?
Well, I think, of course, we have a huge integrity problem. First, I'd like to say that there's good people working in the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office. They don't deserve to be working under a cloud of suspicion because of the actions of a few. So the first thing is to return integrity to that office. I've done that both around the country. I've done it internationally on military assignments such as Afghanistan. So when we look at that, we have to trust people. And those people that we trust, we need to get back working without a cloud of suspicion. Also, generally speaking, absent the current problems that are in the top of the news with the prosecuting attorney, there's some questions that I have, generally speaking, about how the office operates in the areas of proactive or reactive prosecutions, and it also in seizures of drug assets, and also what type of drug crimes are being prosecuted. Our community has a lot of issues, and we need to work collectively to make those answerable.
I hope our listeners understand the difference between proactive and reactive prosecutions. You listed that amongst your top particular points there.
Mark, I have a history of being a state police officer, being a state police homicide investigator, and being a prosecutor. As I tell people, I've sold cases to prosecutors, and I've also bought cases from investigators. A prosecutor needs to be involved from the very beginning of an investigation, not at the end of the investigation. Reactive prosecution is when the police come in, drop off a case, and wait for an attorney to review it. Proactive prosecutions are when the attorney is involved with the police officers, with the investigators, at every stage of that investigation so that there is no wait time when the investigation is done. It's been done correctly, and the prosecution and the police work as a team.
And you would say that the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office is too reactive and not proactive enough? Is that your point?
It is my point, because that's probably true for 95% of the prosecutor's offices around the country.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts here involving the heroin epidemic? It's been called an epidemic by just about everybody. What role does the prosecutor's office have in this relatively recent but very serious problem?
I think the prosecutor's office has a very big role in this. The prosecuting attorney needs to be a leader in the community, needs to bring people to the table. The heroin epidemic right now is one that's not going to be solved by arresting and incarcerating our way through this. It's going to be solved by getting realistic drug treatment for those people who are addicted to these substances. When you get those people treated, you'll get the information you need as to how this is getting into our community and start turning things around. I did that in New Mexico under Governor Gary Johnson, who's now a Libertarian candidate for president. It's hard because you have to face down some people in law enforcement that believe arresting and incarcerating is an answer. It's really not.
One of the things that I've learned in these series of interviews with prosecutor candidates is that an effective prosecutor, I take it, correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems to come through in all of our interviews. An effective prosecutor walks some kind of tightrope between being hard-nosed and prosecutorial on one hand and compassionate and understanding, contextual, you might say, on the other hand, keeping in mind people's life circumstances when those are important. Am I looking at this role accurately when I say that or not?
I think you're accurate in the sense that that line that you're talking about walking is what we call justice. Justice doesn't require us just to enforce every law exactly as it's written. We do have to follow the law, but there's prosecutorial discretion in which you take in the consequences of people. I give the example when I was a young state policeman, they would say, if you're going to issue a citation, decide it before you leave your car. And I'd always look at it and go, but I haven't talked to the motorist yet. Yeah. I haven't seen what they have to say. And
what was
what's
that
going
bad
on.
Advice then?
It's the way it worked at that time.
I see.
And this is where I think we're in a different realm, and I think it's a chance for Ingham County as a community to get a prosecuting attorney who is going to listen to the community with compassion, enforce the law, but seek justice, not just convictions.
I'm speaking with Tom English. Mr. English is a Democratic candidate for Ingham County prosecutor. Sex trafficking is in the news a good deal more here just in recent years. What are your thoughts on that issue with regard to the role the prosecutor's office would play?
Again, prosecutor has to be that leader in the community. The bottom line is when you're not effectively and aggressively prosecuting your sexual assault crimes, you're creating an environment in which human traffickers can put people into a community. We need to be very active in our sexual assault prosecutions. The mere fact that the state of Michigan has so many untested rape kits, each one of those rape kits is a victim who was attacked. And we need to change that attitude because once we start getting aggressive in sexual assaults, domestic violence, making sure we're looking at what's happening in our community and how it affects women, then we'll have an impact on keeping human trafficking out of our county.
Now, cracking down on drunk driving is important to you. You've got a particular history of pursuing this issue and pursuing drunk drivers, I take it. Talk to us about what you've done and what you think needs to be done in Ingham County.
Mark, I came up with a national program which won an award for innovation in tracking habitual drunk drivers. Habitual drunk driver is someone who's been convicted of drunk driving 3 to 5 times in like a 5-year period. Statistically, those drivers drive 1,000 times undetected for each one of those convictions. We know who they are. We should not wait until they go the wrong way on an interstate and wipe out a family. We need to track those individuals. We need to give them opportunities at treatment and to get out of the alcohol problem that they're in. If they don't get out, then we need to know who they are so our police officers can keep their eye out and stop them before they kill another family.
You've said that your leadership was probably at its strongest when you were in the Army serving in Afghanistan. Explain to us why you say that.
I think it's much like an athletic team. The better team you play, the better you play. The bigger the challenge, the better that you can perform. And the challenge in Afghanistan was to keep our detention operations running through the oversight of the administrative and Afghan criminal processing system. It was a tough job to do for General Petraeus, and we rose to the challenge, changed the system, gave them what they needed to keep our warfighters in the fight and humanely treat the detainees and get those who didn't need to be locked up back to their families.
You've alluded to a variety of different roles that you've had in your career, a pretty rich resume here. Which experience do you feel best prepared you to do the job of Ingham County prosecutor?
I think being a prosecutor for 12 and a half years is the best part of doing that. Of course, coming in with police experience, working from prosecutors on that angle and working as a judge helps because you hear people, you learn to listen to people. But being a prosecutor is understanding the day in, the day out of the need to enforce those laws, the need to work through that system, the ability to work plea bargains so that the system rolls smoothly and how to deal with difficult witnesses.
You've said that as a police officer and homicide investigator, your job was impacted by the prosecutors you worked under. How does a prosecutor impact the job of the police?
Well, if you have a proactive prosecutor, they're going to help you through the course of your investigation. They're going to support you and your higher-ups in your department when you need resources or travel or things like that. When they're just reactive, you're taking a guess as to what they want. And they want just a box delivered, and they'll get back to you with the case, and you wait. Well, that's not a really good way to do that. And when I saw that, that's what led me to put myself through college, working second shift, and then put myself through law school, because I looked at those lawyers and thought, I'm as smart as they are, and I can do this job myself.
Are you originally from Michigan?
No, I'm originally from New Mexico, came here 12 years ago. Love water, grass, and trees. They're a great combination, especially in our Michigan summertime, and this is where my wife and I are staying.
We've got to have more of that than they do in New Mexico, I assume. You prosecuted the largest case in U.S. District Court in New Mexico. Can you tell us about that case?
It was a violent street gang came from Los Angeles into Albuquerque, New Mexico. They set about a plan to execute African-American crack cocaine dealers. They committed 6 murders and 7 attempted murders. I indicted them under the racketeering laws under federal law. It was a death penalty case approved by Attorney General Janet Reno. We were able to clean out a neighborhood, take 23 of the most violent individuals anybody has ever seen and lock them up in federal prison. And what a mailman said to me was probably most important. He said, I hear kids playing. I hear kids laughing in a neighborhood that used to just resound with gunshots and screaming.
Animal cruelty is another issue you care a lot about. You're a self-proclaimed dog lover. Do you feel Ingham County needs to improve the way it handles animal cruelty?
Well, I think we do. I think people need to understand the significance of animal cruelty and how it leads on to eventually to human cruelty. That's an early start to look at somebody, for the system to take a look at an individual before they start victimizing humans and more animals.
This issue involving opioids and heroin, I want to get back to that because this can get very tricky. You've got addiction issues that are in play. You've got physicians who are dispensing legal medications. That sounds like just a really complicated landscape. Can you shed any light on how you navigate that landscape?
Yeah, it's not that difficult in my view. We've handled it many times around the country. The addiction problems need to be treated with mental health treatment and substance abuse. There's plenty of advocacy programs, Families Against Narcotics, Narcotics Anonymous, who help with that stuff. We just have to give them a chance. For the physicians, we have to conduct diversion investigations. We can tell when physicians are over-prescribing opiates, and they need to be investigated because they hold their license through the Drug Enforcement Administration, which can be revoked if needed.
You've spoken out on your Facebook page in support of gun control and other issues, closing the loopholes involving background checks. This has gotten an awful lot of talk this week with the Orlando tragedy. What role does the county prosecutor play in contending with an issue like gun control?
Again, in being a leader in the community, the county prosecutor needs to be aware of all the firearms crimes that are being committed, know where those firearms are coming from. You need to pay attention to it from a firearms trafficking perspective. I think also the county prosecutor must remain very firm on any firearms that are not secured, that they're handled by children, they're stolen, needs to be looked at very carefully for prosecution.
We have been speaking with Tom English. Mr. English is a Democratic candidate for Ingham County Prosecutor. By the way, you can listen to our previous interviews with Republican candidate Billy Joe O'Berry, along with Democrats Brian Jackson, Patrick O'Keefe, and Carol Seaman at WKAR.org. Just go to the radio link and the current state link. Tom English, good luck. Nice to meet you, and best of luck.
Thank you, Mark. The Pat Zelenka Project of Lansing, Michigan. Pat Zelenka, Bruce Ignatowski, and Raz Rosados there. What's that called, Pat?
That is called As the Years Go Passing By. That's a song by Albert King.
Albert King, yeah. Of course. Fantastic. Yeah. More from the Pat Zelenka Project here in just a little bit. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. If you're a garden buff, you may enjoy a new exhibit opening this weekend at the Flint Institute of Arts. Current State's Jamie Paisley took a closed-door preview of this installation and joins me now. Hi, Jamie. What'd you see?
Well, I mean, when I drove to Flint, I mean, I knew a bit about this new exhibit called Moving Toward the Light, about the watercolor paintings of American artist Joseph Raphael. But, you know, I hadn't really, you know, realized the scope, or more accurately, the size of these artworks that will be opening up this weekend at the Flint Institute of Arts. These kind of giant-sized, realist watercolors featuring close-up details of various flowers and nature scenes. I mean, it looks a lot like an Instagram filter, honestly. To learn more about the creation of these artworks by Joseph Raphael, I got a one-on-one tour of this new gallery that's opening up this weekend with a representative of the Flint Institute of Arts.
My name is Sarah Cohn. I'm the assistant curator at the Flint Institute of Arts.
As we walk into Graphics Gallery, you're first kind of struck with the size of this new exhibit, Moving Toward the Light, with Joseph Raphael and his works. I mean, there's immediately to the left, must be maybe seven feet by 6 feet, this giant watercolor exhibit. And is that's the most striking thing that I think as I'm walking into the gallery.
Yeah, I think the size of all of his works is definitely one of the most impressive aspects of them. But really, the other thing that draws me is the color. But the size, I mean, almost all of these works are over 5 feet tall or 5 feet wide.
And speaking of the color, as the installation is still ongoing for this weekend's opening up of the gallery to the public, is that part of the concern of getting this right? Because watercolors are fairly delicate. Even when you're in your darkest tones, they're very delicate. So the lighting, is that a major concern that you have when you're installing this?
Well, yeah. Anytime you install a work on paper, you want to make sure your light levels are relatively low because the pigment and the paper can deteriorate much more quickly than another medium. The major issue that we had here, we deal with low lights a lot, but they're so big, we had to figure out how many lights you can put on these to illuminate them and give them this beautiful glow without having the light level too high. Definitely a problem.
As far as Joseph Raphael as an artist, what can you tell me about his background? I know he's still alive. He's still in his early to mid-80s as well. What else can you let us know about his style, his life, his background?
Sure. He actually, I think one of the most striking things about him is that he studied under another really well-known artist named Joseph Albers, who we have a painting in our collection by Joseph Albers. The key difference is Albers was incredibly minimal in his style, whereas Raphael's paintings are incredibly naturalistic. I mean, you see the flowers, you kind of feel the texture. So having this modern master as your inspiration is incredible to start off with, but also how Raphael incorporated the color theory that Albers really focused on is, in his own way, is really fantastic. Albers talked a lot about gestalt design, so you're thinking of the entire process, everything together. Raphael embraces that, but he actually works in a way where he doesn't really know what happens until it's completed. He has an idea of what the finished product's going to be, but he loves to let the paint make the painting. He lets that have control, and that's why one reason he chooses watercolors.
As I look closer at that same artwork, which first struck me as I entered the Graphics Gallery at the Flint Institute of Arts, a watercolor called New Cycle, I see a rather large vertical line in the art, which Assistant Curator Sarah Cohn lets me know is another piece of paper that Joseph Raphael used to create this watercolor.
So what he says about the size, we know his works are monumental, but he says the size is not dictated by me. The image dictates the size. So he starts his process by taking a photograph of the natural world, usually. In this case, flowers, fish, rocks. And he then uses that photograph to create what he calls a map on the paper. So what happens is sometimes the work just becomes massive. And in that particular instance, what you're seeing is a seam with two pieces of paper. He didn't have paper large enough, so he had to have two. And there are a number of works that have that seam. It's incredibly fascinating. You just think, oh goodness, I don't have enough paper. This is so big. And so they're perfectly aligned, the two pieces of paper.
We're speaking with Sarah Cohn, the assistant curator of the Flint Institute of Art, speaking about the new Moving Toward the Light exhibit. And we're in half the gallery right now. It's a fairly small gallery, so let's walk over to the other side. I haven't seen any of these yet. And if you could just, of the ones that you would see here, which is the one that strikes you, and could you describe it for us as well?
So I'm standing in front of a relatively large watercolor that is an image of his pond. He moved to France about 30 years ago, and him and his wife live in relative wilderness. But what they've done is they've created this massive yard with lots of flowers, lots of trees, but in particular two koi ponds. So what we're actually looking at is an image of one of the koi ponds with these, I believe they're Buddhist prayer flags, dangling above. So you see the flags in the top corner, and then you're actually looking down at the water, and not only do you see the fish, but you see the reflection of the flags and the greenery around it. In one sense, it reminds me of paintings by Monet.
Yeah, the water lilies.
Exactly. And in another sense, it reminds me of Vincent van Gogh for the color, the really rich color. And he was inspired in particularly by Vincent van Gogh. I absolutely love this because of the dynamic, vibrant colors, the bright oranges, the blue is incredibly intense, and the fish, you know, swimming throughout. They're at once abstracted, but when you actually kind of step back from the paintings, you see beautiful reflections and the movement of the water.
Exactly, because these aren't, the reflections aren't at all pure elements. You have the prayer flags above it, and then these abstractions of the movement of the water. Fantastic. So we're currently in the exhibit, and how long is this going to be on display, starting this weekend?
So it opens on the 18th, and it runs until September 18th. There are 11 works in the show, and there are two in the hallway. The rest are in the main gallery space. It is a fantastic representation of summer. I think that's one of the things I like the best about this, is you walk in, and the gallery is relatively small, but then you have these larger-than-life paintings, vibrant colors, fish, flowers. It just explodes color. And to me, that reminds me of spring and summer and the warm weather, which is great.
It's an accessible feature for exactly that reason, that summertime feel.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. They adore it. We've had a handful of people who work here come through and just their eyes light up. We also have a book that came out called Moving Towards the Light, which illustrates almost all of the works in this exhibition. But in addition to that, there are 80 other paintings by him in this beautiful text. So it's a really fantastic addition to seeing these in person. But I like the idea of seeing them in person because you get the sense of the scale. You can look at these on paper and really realize, okay, 6 foot by 4. And then you think, oh goodness, this is taller than me. And the colors, the texture of the paint, it kind of envelops you. And that's what Raphael was going for. He loves watercolors for that reason.
We're here in the graphics gallery at the Flint Institute of Art with a preview of the exhibit of watercolors by Joseph Raphael, Moving Towards the Light, on display this weekend. And you can find out more information at flintarts.org. We've been speaking with Sarah Cohn, the assistant curator at the Flint Institute of Arts. Sarah, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And I'm Mark Bayshore, and our Live Music Friday performers here today, the Pat Zelenka Project. They play rock and funk and blues, and they're kind of a jam band. And rock session guitarist Dick Wagner called Pat Zelenka one of his favorite unsung guitar heroes. That is pretty high praise.
That meant a lot to me, yeah.
I imagine it did. This lineup has been together for about a year and a half. Yep. Pat Zelenka, Bruce Ignatowski, and Raz Rosados. Let's hear Magnolia Sunset.
when I remember those nights you cried. When I think back, those times I lied. Things were so simple, things were so true. My baby blue. Magnolia sunset, sweet summer sunbeams, cool summer breezes carry on our dreams. Do you remember her? Ah, tell me true. My baby blue. Waves crash on the sand as they have for all time. I lay my head back, rest my weary mind. Can you hear them? Doesn't make it through. My baby blue.
The Pat Zelenka Project, Magnolia Sunset, here on Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. Great to have you on the program, Pat. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Oh, okay. Excellent. We love to hear that. Your cohorts here, Bruce Ignatowski on bass and Raz Rosados, Mike Raz Rosados on drums. Yep. Do you consider yourselves a power trio? I saw you listed Cream as one of your influences.
Sure. Yeah, Cream era Eric Clapton, I think, for a lot of guitar players.
Sure.
Definitely a huge influence. And the John Mayall work before that too.
But do you consider yourselves a power trio more or less?
I guess
is it always
so.
Just you three guys?
It's always just us three. And it's just so compact and easy to travel with.
Yeah.
Mainly, you know, and the musical communication is such that it's so much easier as a trio.
It's got to be.
I think so, yeah.
One of my favorite workout radio stations, you know, internet radio stations, mm-hmm. is the Robin Trower radio station.
Yeah.
Good workout
Love
music.
Robin Trower, yeah.
And that is a mountain of music coming out of, for a lot of years, just three instruments.
Three people. Yeah. Reg Isidore on the drums. It's such a great band.
Yeah. So I take it there's been a Pat Zelenka project for about a decade with this current lineup in place about a year and a half. What were your original ideas for the group? Were your original ideas basically what we're hearing today?
Exactly. And it's funny you mentioned Robin Trower, because that was definitely the prototype that I was basing that on.
Well,
I
that just is thought, a great prototype.
Well,
to
I'd been
base
in a lot
on.
Of bands. I'd played bass and guitar for a lot of people over the years. And the problem I had was that if something went sideways with the band, there was no way to stop that. I was just a member. And so I thought, well, what if I followed like a Robin Trower kind of template? And that was how this came to be.
Yeah. You don't play.
It wasn't an ego thing. It was an ability to do something cohesive that I knew I could keep together and always be able to work.
Trower's renowned for his Fender Strat, though. You play a Gibson Les Paul.
Well, I own a Strat, too.
Okay,
but
I'm not surprised.
I love Les Pauls. Yeah, okay. I love Les Pauls for sure.
And you guys play upwards of 200 live gigs a year.
Yep.
How do you do that?
Tiring, but...
Why do you do that?
No. I do that because I have such a passion for it. I mean, this is what I live and breathe and do. It's not a hobby for me.
Yeah.
It's definitely my poor long-suffering wife Barb, who I love very much, would tell you that mainly what she hears at dinner conversation or any other time of the day is either the History Channel or some book I've read on history, or I'm talking about music history. You know, great sessions, you know, Brian Wilson, I'm talking about Led Zeppelin, I'm talking about B.B. Albert and Freddie King, I'm talking about tours that they had, and she just kind of goes, yep. We've been married for a long time, so she's heard them all.
Describe the ideal gig. What does the ideal gig have that a less than ideal gig doesn't have?
Yeah. Red M&Ms in the bowl, as Raz says. No, the ideal gig is there's people there who are excited to hear live music played well. And they're excited to be out for the weekend. My average listener probably works all week at a job, and they're out for the weekend. They just want to have a good time, and I'm there to provide that entertainment. So if I can give to them and they reciprocate by giving back to me, that they're, you know, just the fun of it all. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there gigs where you struggle to engage the audience?
Oh, I think every musician has that, yeah. But, if you know, it just really... I try to keep it very lighthearted on stage, kind of what Bruce Lee would call having fun seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're laughing, and it engages the audience. And even the most hard-to-win-over audiences enjoy seeing a band who's smiling and laughing and having a good time. Yeah,
I imagine audiences, though, it's 2016. It's mm-hmm. the era of the smartphone. It is here to stay, I imagine.
Sure.
I imagine their audiences generally must be more distracted than they used to be.
Yes.
You ever look up and see somebody on their smartphone in the middle?
All the time, yeah.
What does that do to you? Repeat that. Here.
Yeah, you have the mic.
There's at least 50% of our jobs, there's television screens constantly. Yeah, everywhere.
Okay.
People are
watching
TV.
Yeah.
Has that been a big adjustment? Does that get great on your nerves?
Not really, because you're the radio, and they enjoy hearing you, and people are dancing. But yeah, it's the to draw people in, a lot of clubs have had to switch over to a lot of things like that just to keep people in. And,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Often people will get excited about what we're playing. Like Pat says, there's an energy between the three of us that I think we convey. People will take their smartphone and take videos of us while they're, and then they'll post it to their Facebook page. And so it's nice to get audiences excited in that way with interacting with their technology.
There's the silver lining, I guess. Describe a typical set list for us here. We've got some originals, some covers, is it a combination?
I mix them up. Well, to work anymore, you have to have some covers. I insert about two or three originals per set. Mm-hmm. But we play a lot of different cover songs that range anywhere from the Beatles to the Meters to Albert King to Robin Trower. We play some Robin Trower.
Oh, really?
The nice thing about it, and some funk and whatnot, and the nice thing is that I do the covers as my own version. All my heroes did that. They came up with versions of those songs that they like to do. That made it fun for them, and it made it fun for the audience. The audience got to hear what they wanted to hear, and the artists got to express themselves. So I've always used that as my template.
I'm looking over the tracks on your latest CD, mm-hmm. which just came out last year, the Elm Street Sessions 4/30/14. I see Well, these are eclectic selections.
Yeah,
Jimi Hendrix to Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yes.
So the Meters, Kenny Burrell, and nothing by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
No, I was going to do a version of You're Having My Baby by the Mormon Tabernacle
okay.
Choir,
all
but
right.
I decided not to, so
let's
I
hear,
couldn't.
Let's hear another track. What do you guys want to play?
Well, let's do something. We'll do the opening track of the CD. This is one by Kenny Burrell called Chitlins Con Carne.
Kenny Burrell composition there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Chitlins Con Carne, been covered by a bunch of folks, covered
yep.
this morning on WKAR's Current State by the Pat Zolenka Project. The band has gigged at, is it the Bohm Theater?
The Bohm Theater,
Bohm
yeah,
Theater
in Albion,
a refurbished movie theater. They're hosting a series of blues programs down there. Tell us about the shows at the Bohm.
Well, it's called Blues at the Bohm. It's every Monday at 7. And what you do is you have a host band like us, and we'll come out and play a set. And then they'll have various people that will come up and sit in with the band, jam. At the end of the night, we play a closing set. So they booked a lot of great bands there, and I was really honored to be able to contact them and get a slot. I mean,
nice venue.
Oh, beautiful. Completely restored theater from the 1920s. Mm. They got a grant, And, I mean, every square inch of that looks like it's a brand new theater from 1922. It's beautiful in there. Yeah.
What else do they do besides live music at the BOEM? Yeah. This is the first I've heard of them.
Yeah, and it's a little-known program, and I really try to tell a lot of people about it because they were so gracious and so nice, and the sound was so well done there. They've retrofitted that theater. If you ever decide to see a movie there with 7.1 surround sound. And a digital
projector.
So
it still shows movies.
Oh,
that's,
constantly.
That
all
question.
Week, all weekend. Okay. Yeah, Monday is just blues night there. And we had such a great time and such a professional crew that, yeah, it was just totally worth
it. It's great to know that's happening. The BOEM Theater in Albion, their blues program. You got several gigs scheduled this summer at Champions in Holt.
Champions in Holt, and we're at Buddy's in Holt. We're also at Red Cedar Spirits in East Lansing. We have a special guest at that gig, Michelle Fish. Some people around town know her. She's going to sing for us that night just for fun. We play a couple hours there at Red Cedar. If you've been to Red Cedar, it's such a special place, such a great place over in East Lansing.
The project's fourth LP is going to be all instrumentals. How did that idea take shape?
Well, I'd done the previous two albums, which are Radio Soul and Better Days. And I'd done an instrumental album called Lo-Fi Happiness. And I was in the studio doing a fourth album with all vocals. And every Monday back then, I used to host a jam at Michigan Brewing Company, downtown Lansing. And we had an alternating rotation of jazz drummers from MSU. And we had a guy named Nate Woodring. And every other Monday he was there. And every time Nate would play, it just turned into a whole other level.
Wow.
And that set that you see there on the CD was the set we played with him every other Monday. So I really wanted to record it. I didn't have any of those titles in my catalog, and I didn't intend on doing an all-instrumental album. It just came out that way.
You've said that music is it for you.
Yep.
It is your career. It is your life. Mm-hmm. And working at Elderly Instruments is a piece of that.
It helps.
As well. Yeah.
No, very proud to have worked at Elderly. Bruce and I both have. He's been there longer than I have, but I've been there since March of 2000, and it's an incredible company to work for. Stan Werben and the whole Werben family are just fantastic people to know. And it's a wealth of history. Stan's been doing this since 1972 and before. So Elderly just started in 1972. He'd been doing this from the 60s into the 70s. So He's the Library of Congress for instrument knowledge.
He sure
absolutely,
is.
Absolutely.
He was just on the show recently,
doing
a banjo session here.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in a musical family?
My grandfather on my mother's side was. On the Zelenka side, there are cousins of my grandfather who were polka players. And the ZCBJ halls that you see like in Owosso, Michigan and whatnot, the Z was Zelenka. And so they built halls so when they retired, they could play. That was the story told to me.
Bannister. I've attended the ZCBJ
hall. There's one
hall
in Bannister,
Michigan. Yep.
And they were built back in the 40s and 50s by these guys because
and
they wanted
Z
a place to play.
And ZCBJ stands for Zelenka?
Yep, that's what I understood from him, from my grandfather, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Louis Zelenka. And then on my mother's side, her father, Ken Cushman, was upright bass, tenor, banjo, guitar, piano, and he played all over mid-Michigan and Detroit and lived in Royal Oak throughout the Second World War, played all through there. A lot of country swing was his thing, yeah.
Do you remember your first guitar?
Yes, unfortunately.
Do you still own it?
No, it was a terrible guitar. I didn't know it because I was just not smart about that yet. It was a child's guitar from a JCPenney catalog. And the strings were about an inch off the neck, and I played and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And what was funny was somebody had brought over a guitar they found in a free box at a garage sale, had one string on it. I don't remember if it was my mom or my sister, but they brought it over, and I said, can I hold it? And I don't remember who said it, but someone laughed and said, what are you going to do, play it? And I thought, well, I will. And so I borrowed this cheap guitar from a friend, and when it finally fell apart. But I played that for a long time, and just kept going.
And every time you got a new guitar, it just felt fantastic.
It felt a lot better than that first
it
one.
It sure did. That's the beautiful thing about good musical instruments.
Absolutely.
Where can people find your music?
They can find my music, any download service that you're aware of, but Spotify, iTunes, Rhapsody. You can also find me, elderly.com is the website, and Elm Street Sessions is for sale there. Stock code is radio-cd5. At elderly.com, but you can just search my name on there. And if you need to find out more about the band or anything, facebook.com/PZ Project. We're on Twitter, Tumblr, all the sites that you can imagine. And if you just Google search Pat Zelenka, and if you want to see footage from the Bohm Theater, just type in Pat Zelenka Bohm, B-O-H-M.
Got it.
Into Google.
Yep. Very good. Best of luck. When is the next CD due out, real quickly?
The next CD is due out in 2017. I'm going to guesstimate spring or summer.
Very good. And yep, our listeners know where to go for it. Lots of options there.
Absolutely.
Online. We're going to have you play us out after I remind our listeners that Monday on Current State, we will talk with Lansing City Councilwoman Carol Wood about the appointment of Jim Smirtka to the position of city attorney. The interim city attorney, Joe Abood, is out. Jim Smirtka is in. And we will also talk about the state of Michigan's annual quest for the next state Christmas tree. It starts in the summer. We'll learn about that coming up on Monday's Current State. Pat Zelenka Project, our Live Music Friday guests here, Raz Rosados and Bruce Ignatowski. Pat Zelenka, thank you very much. They're going to play us out on Current State.
All right. We'll be right back.